This week on Pop of Culture, we stay on beat and in motion. We'll talk to Ifideo Gatling of the Harlem Gospel Travelers.
And that's a part of our mission, is to help people to know that they're welcome in all different spaces and they're welcome in this world to love and be who they should be and who they are.
We learn about the Clay Olympics from renowned local potter John Peterson.
We had a, you know, who can throw the tallest cylinder, you know, who can pull the longest handle, and that kind of stuff.
Coming up.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Coming up in approximately 11 minutes, a conversation with local pottery legend John Peterson.
But before that, our co-host Michelle Kinsey brings us the gospel.
Grammy-nominated vocal trio, the Harlem Gospel Travelers, will bring their modern take on traditional gospel music to Muncie on June 13th as part of the Muncie Three Trails music series.
When the world starts to get you down and you can't seem to raise your head, find yourself on the wrong side of town, find out what somebody said.
Here to talk about the group is one of the founders, Ifideo Gatling. Thank you so much for joining us on Pop of Culture.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to y'all and to give y'all a little piece of the HGT groove.
Yes. Well, Ifideo, let's start at the beginning. How did this group, the Harlem Gospel Travelers, come together? I understand you were teenagers. Is that right?
Yes. Long, long time ago. Picture it, Harlem. You know, if, for those of you that get that reference, I appreciate you. But it was a long time ago. We all traveled together to Harlem to learn and study and sing gospel music. And originally, it was just supposed to be something that was for fun. Mm-hmm. And then developed into a group as I started writing original music for us. And we started growing and developing. We originally started out as an actual quartet with like we were never a quartet with just four members. We had like eight members at first.
Oh, wow.
And then it ended up kind of dwindling down like Survivor, kind of. And so we went from like eight to three. And so now we are the power trio that you talked about now. I met my group member, Dennis Keith Bailey, when I was in college, and I asked him to join. And it's been the three of us killing the game ever since.
Right. And the other member is George, right?
Yes, George Mirage. Yes. That is our falsetto powerhouse right there. And then you have Dennis Keith Bailey, the third, if you will. And he is our cool guy, our hip hop. He is the jack of all trades.
Nice, nice. Let's talk about your relationship with gospel music. You are a pastor's child, so I'm guessing you heard traditional gospel music all the time.
Absolutely. I grew up with having both of my parents are pastors, and so I grew up with having the very traditional Baptist church experience and hearing a lot of hymns and a lot of spirituals. And then I also had a more modern church experience, which is I grew up in the time of the really big choirs and praise and worship teams and a lot of group singing and a lot of really high powerhouse singing. And so those are all of the different sounds that inspired me growing up. And then also hearing my parents preach, that is also an extension of singing. And my parents, that all that hooping and hollering that I do, I get it from my mama and I get it from my daddy. So I was able to really sit at the feet of all of these different sounds and soak them up and bring them to the music that I love and that I enjoy and kind of merge all of the different sounds that I grew up with. So you can get a little bit of Yolanda Adams and a little bit of Beyonce, a little bit of Karen Clark Sheard and a little bit of Brandy. It's all mixed in there.
All of it.
I was just standing here thinking how good the Lord has been to me. He opened doors that I could not see.
I loved your video post on the Grammy nomination First, congrats on being the first non-binary person to be nominated for a Gospel Grammy. I loved the video. You were so excited. What does that mean to you?
Thank you so much. And that video was hilarious because we really had no idea that we were going to get nominated. So getting that email that we were nominated in the airport was surreal. And I feel like I'm so mad that we're not on television because that would have been a great episode. It would have been very... I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to, you know, put us on the TV, I'm
there
telling you right now, mm-hmm. you know, get you some awards real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, it's surreal as an artist and as somebody that has dreamed about, you know, doing this for all of my life to now and forever be Grammy nominated is something that the three of us have dreamed about all of our lives, and to be nominated together is another layer to that dream. And then also for us to make history,
yes.
with our first nomination, it's just layers upon layers upon layers of just extending your dream beyond even like what we expected. And that is really connected in our faith, is that God will give you the desires of your heart and more. We're just hoping that it inspires other people to, you know, whether you believe in God or not, to understand that anything is possible. We continue to bring our very best, and we continue to be blessed by that. And so that, it means everything.
He will save you.
You perform in front of all kinds of audiences. What's it like to bring this music to people who are hearing it with fresh ears?
It is the most invigorating and most rewarding experience to bring this style of music into areas and to people that might not necessarily listen to gospel music. It's a feeling that cannot be duplicated. And it's something that people tell us all the time, like, I would have never, you know, expected to feel this way, but now I'm inspired to, you know, reconnect with my faith, or to, you know, now I feel like I'm welcome in this space that I never thought that I would be in. And that's a part of our mission, is to help people to know that they're welcome in all different spaces and they're welcome in this world to love and be who they should be and who they are.
Oh, I love that.
Searching for
audiences expect, or what do you want them to feel? You have said before that music is music as long as it makes you feel something. What do you want the audience in Muncie to feel?
We want you to feel a joy that is contagious. We want you to feel an energy, feel like you can do anything. We want you to leave the show feeling better than what you when you came, and that you feel like anything is possible, that you can do anything, that you can inspire other people, that you are seen, that you are loved. And above all else, we want you to see a show that you never forget and hear some powerhouse vocals, see some dance moves, see some outfits. It's going to be something that you are going to want to tell other people about, and something that you are going to want to remember.
I love that. Is there a song that you love to perform the most when you're on the road?
You know, you're asking a different question, because usually people ask us what's our favorite song on the record, and I always have an answer for that. But my favorite song to perform honestly changes depending on the audience. But I think that it's evolving into, we have a song called Ever Since. And the way that we do it in the live show is there's a whole part where we really kind of bless the crowd and speak affirmations over them. And that's become my favorite part of the show, because you really get to see people light up. And also we really just get that connection and that fire with them to say, like, we're speaking love and positivity over your lives, and that's what we're here to do. And also that song really hits.
And if I may, you're also there to make people get up out of their seats and dance, because Rhapsody from start to finish is fantastic. I was out of my seat and dancing from the first note of that album. What an amazing album. And I loved the 60s grooves. It was like the Staples Singers type sound. It was Just absolutely fantastic. Love that album.
You know it. You know it. Thank you so much. It's a quote my group member, George. This is gospel music for the dance floor, so everybody got to get up. What did Tita Marie say? Everybody get up.
That's right. That's exactly right. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us, and congratulations on all of the success. And I cannot wait for Muncie to experience HGT.
Thank you so much. I really had a great time speaking to y'all, and I cannot wait for you guys to see this show. I'm telling you right now, the Rhapsody experience is something that you don't want to miss.
We are ready. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Kara Duquette. John Peterson is a principal part of the rich tradition of ceramics in East Central Indiana, and he has been doing this for about 50 years. Thank you so much for being here, John.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us how you got into making pottery?
I was lucky enough to have a high school art teacher in Skokie, Illinois, who had been a Ball State graduate and a ceramic enthusiast. So I was a junior in high school when myself and some of my friends started taking art classes, and there was a potter's wheel and lots of clay. So that was my introduction. I bought a potter's wheel when I was a senior in high school, and it was kind of my summer activity with Bob Stein, my good friend. We both were making pots, and I had a garage in a little neighborhood. We turned into a studio and, spent the summer, making pots and, being artistic.
Yeah. Now, so you really liked it since you bought a wheel. Did you then build a kiln?
No, we never had a kiln. We didn't think that far ahead. We were happy just making things. I remember we took some of the pots over to a high school next door, New Trier High School. There was a sympathetic art teacher there that fired some of our work during the summer. And, at that age, things just kind of transpire. And I don't know what happened to all those things or not, but we were full of enthusiasm.
John had so much more to tell us about how he met his business partner, Alan Patrick, and how they started the renowned Bethel Pike Pottery Studios. He also talked about his mentor at Ball State, Marvin Reichel, and how he's still impacting John's life. That's where our conversation picks up. Now, what inspires you to continue potting over time? You talked about the importance of Marvin Reichel in your life and his teaching. Teachers. Is that why you became a teacher?
I think so. Everything that I did, I can go back and find a connection to Marvin. Mm-hmm. Marvin was he taught lifestyle as much as he taught art. He did a lot of work on his house, had beautiful gardens, had every element of his life, had an aesthetic that he pursued. So I think that's the kind of thing I like to teach, is to have an artistic life. Mm-hmm. And then everything kind of falls into place after that.
I can see that from I've had the pleasure of going out and seeing the space that you're talking about, and it's very inspiring.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming spring sale?
Well, we have probably the 50th, spring open house.
Wow.
And backtrack a little bit, because Alan and I started the Bethel Pottery, and then, about 4 or 5 years into it, we split it up because he had a certain direction he wanted to go, and I had a little different direction. Alan was more interested in wholesaling, so he that was a bigger part of his business, and I was going to art fairs and selling retail. We'd always had a spring show, and after we split up, I think we kind of missed a few years, but then I started having a spring show again. And about 20 years ago, we had some friends that wanted to take classes, and I was giving some classes to some people in my studio. And so we've kind of expanded that. So now we have about 15 people Some of them have been coming for 20 years. And the school is loosely a school. It's like a more like a clay club. You know, and some wonderful people and some very good potters. And some of these people have their own studios, too. And this. So we started having the students sell their work in the spring at the spring show in the school. And then I have my work in my studio. So.
And Alan, is he still on the property?
Yeah, it's still on the property. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the commune became...
And Alan quit making pots about 15 years ago. Mm. And he was always a painter in school. So he just continued. Now he's a painter.
Wonderful. Yeah.
So the June 7th and 8th, we have our open house. We have the students' work. There's 15 students. And we have my work. We have some music. We have some kind of a clay Olympics, if you'd like, where you can have... You can challenge other people. The kids can make a pot or two if they want. And there's some food out there probably. And it's a nice event, you know. It's a great event.
I saw Ron Richcreek showing some children how to pot.
Yeah.
But now what's this Olympics? What do you mean you can challenge people? Well, in what way?
We had a, you know, who can throw the tallest cylinder?
Oh.
You know, who can pull the longest handle and that kind of stuff. You know.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I would like to know, how do you balance your form and functionality when you create pots?
You know, I started out doing, you know, functional ware, utilitarian ware, and still do. I think that's just my nature. You know, that's more satisfying to me is to make something that people can use. And because I use my pots, you know, so I have an everyday experience testing everything I make. Mm. And, you know, hopefully people will get the same feeling out of these pieces that I get. And I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, I ask you that because you make such beautiful things, but it's very clear that you can utilize them.
Yeah.
And
And there's a, you know, there's a great tradition of functional pottery, you know, and I like all, you know, all avenues of ceramics. I appreciate it and enjoy it, but, you know, this is my kind of my thing. So.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your pottery or your art?
You know, I'm 80 years old this year.
Wow.
And so, you know, we're starting to think about winding down a little bit, maybe. You know, I used to do, you know, 12, 15 art fairs all around the country every year. And so the teaching classes kind of augmented that part of my income. I'm kind of a little bit of a dinosaur, and, you know, starting probably, you know, 15 years ago with the internet online exposure. And if I was a potter starting today, that would probably be where I would start, you know, because there's a lot of people that sell work online all over the world. And to be connected, you know, there's different connections that you have to make now than when I started.
Well, and you made them by going places.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, we started having shows out of the school. Well, we were students, so we had a community of friends, you know, from Ball State, and I've got a mailing list of around 800 people. And if you look through it, a lot of them are, you know, older, you know. So actually, yeah. Renee Petrie, my daughter, lives in California, and probably, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. She started helping me get on Facebook and kind of updating my way of exposure. And we did, you know, made a big difference for the shows. We started drawing younger people, you know, and people that are, you know, building a household are the people that buy pots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's the conversation of, you know, all the old friends that say, you know, we love your pots. We have lots of them, you know. So you need to, you know, you need to keep getting new people.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing that and adapting and that you brought the movement here and it continues.
Yeah.
It continues.
Okay. It continues. Yeah.
Thank you so much, John. Yeah.
I've got to, you know, we all kind of, after years and years and years of doing something, it's hard to see how people see you. And it's hard to kind of accept that people see you as, you know, as the, you know, the master or the senior person, you know.
Oh, yeah, because you're as old as you feel, right?
Right, and you never expect that.
No.
But, you know, I'm glad I've been able to inspire some people, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to your spring show. And again, that's going to be on Saturday and Sunday, June 7th and 8th. And it's going to be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Yeah.
And there's going to be food and pottery and Olympics.
Oh, Clay Olympics.
Clay Olympics. And that's at 5801 East Pottery Road, Albany, Indiana, 47320.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
John Peterson is a local potter and has been for over 50 years.
Saturday, June 7th, Pop of Culture will be popping up, trademark, at Ball State's We Fly Fest. We'll be spinning our prize wheel and interviewing festival goers, and we hope you'll be one of them. There will, of course, be many, many other representatives from the university on hand, including the Ball State Studio Band. Our co-host, Michelle Kinsey, stopped by one of their rehearsals back in February.
You're hearing the Ball State University Studio Band, and joining me is Cassius Goins. He is the director of the Studio Band here at Ball State, and he is also associate lecturer of music, specializing in jazz percussion, right?
Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about the Studio Jazz Band.
Okay, so the Studio Band, it was started 2017-2018 by my colleague Christoph Thompson, Dr. Mm-hmm. Thompson, who is the head of our music media and production program here at Ball State. And it was a much smaller outfit than what we have now. It was more like a combo setting, so 5 to 6 students. And they performed out in Muncie and surrounding areas as well, but only like a few times a semester or a year. It's grown a lot since then. Our program has grown, so to keep up with our program and the demands of the students, so has Studio Band.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a glow up of the Studio Band because it seems like I'm seeing the names show up all over the place on social media. Performances at the Jazz Kitchen,
yes.
Performances in town at Be Here Now, private events, fundraisers, galas. I mean, it's all over the place. Why is this so important for the students?
It's so important because it's giving them the necessary tools to be professional musicians in the music industry. So it's giving them the tools. They not only know how to play their instruments mm-hmm. and do it well, they're learning tons of repertoire. So everything from Stevie Wonder to Bruno Mars to Ariana Grande. We do classic soul, funk, R&B. And myself being a musician that's still actively performing every week, multiple times every week, I understand what it takes to kind of be a professional musician. Mm-hmm. And you have to wear many hats. It's I tell my students it's not a straight line, you know, being a musician. So you could get a call to play for a pop group. I got a call to play for a Motown group in a couple weeks.
Wow.
So you never know what you're going to be playing. So I like to have my students be prepared to take those opportunities when they come along. So it's really giving them the tools to do that. But also the other side of the music business, being a professional and knowing how to book gigs, knowing when to show up, knowing how to run a rehearsal, knowing how to run sound. So we set up every day our PA system and our mics and everything, and all of the students have a hand in that. So they're getting a little bit of everything so that they're well-rounded when they get done.
Yeah. It's one thing to be in the classroom or be in kind of a studio session at Ball State. It's another to go out and perform in a variety of different venues. I think that's awesome.
This is a hands-on class, a hands-on ensemble. So
absolutely. I noticed you in rehearsal. You have the biggest grin on your face. Talk to me about how you feel watching these students kind of gel as a band to improve as they go along. And really, I mean, I noticed just in this rehearsal, the stage presence, the audience banter. I mean, they've got that stuff down. How does that make you feel as the director?
I mean, it makes me feel great. You know, it's all about them at the end of the day. So to watch them kind of blossom into their own and to get better as the semester goes along and to watch their camaraderie between each other as well, it's a beautiful thing.
Got Elijah Neal, and he is one of the vocalists with the studio band. Elijah, we just heard you perform some of the tunes that you're going to be performing out and about in concert. First of all, you sounded amazing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Tell me how you got involved with the studio jazz band. Why was this something you wanted to be involved with?
So when I originally came to Ball State campus as a vocal performance major, and granted there are a lot of amazing staples in classical music, but that was all I was doing. And as a vocalist who grew up in church singing gospel, R&B, jazz, like that's my base. Like that's what I love to do. And so at first I wasn't really well versed in the ensembles on campus my first year, but second semester I got to see studio band perform at one of like the collective performances, and I was like, I have to get on stage and do it. And so at the beginning of my sophomore year, which is this year, first semester, I came in on audition, they let me in, and it's just been the most amazing experience getting to do the style of music that I've literally been craving to do.
Time out. So you this is your first year with studio band?
This is.
Oh my goodness, you seem like a veteran. You seem like you, I thought you were gonna say, oh, I'm a senior and I've been with the studio band.
No, I'm just a second year, I'm only 20, years. I'm only 20.
Oh my goodness. What is your favorite part about being in studio band?
All in all, just the creative space to create. Like it is so healing to be able to do a style of music built by vets who created it for people like me. So I just like, it is such an amazing experience to get to do that with like-minded people who also just love to jam out professionally. And it's really fun.
Yeah. How important is that as a student to be able to get these experiences, real, like you said, real professional experiences while you're still in class?
Absolutely. So yeah, like with class, like, ooh, class is so like stressor. And granted, I am very grateful for the opportunity. I'm also a first gen student, so I'm very grateful to be here representing my family in my hometown, Gary, Indiana, Goji.
Hey.
Studio band is my de-stressor. It's my time to relax and create and make music and kind of built this and practiced this portfolio that I'm going to be putting out by the time I'm an upperclassman and wanting to do internships and crazy other places and stuff. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So as you look through, because the band has quite a repertoire, as you look through there, what are some of your favorites on the list?
For me personally, one of my favorite songs to sing is Say Yes by Floetry. It is a very just like sensual, fun song. And I personally don't get to sing in my falsetto much, so I get to kind of unlock this more like feminine, sultry side to when I sing, and I just love that song so much. She's crazy. She like moans like in the song, like she goes crazy. But my favorite song, like to hear sung, is Pretty Wings. Luke sings that song. He's the other male vocalist in our group, and he just, his voice is like, it's literally, it melts. I melt. Wow. I melt every time he opens his mouth. So yeah, Pretty Wings, when he sings that, I'm just in awe.
Wow. Now, since you just joined Studio Band, do you understand, can you comprehend how huge it is that the band is playing at the Jazz Kitchen?
My mom is a singer. That's where I get my little singing quirk from.
Yeah.
And her sisters are performers, and they know artists that have gone to Jazz Band because they're based in Ohio. So they know artists that have performed at Jazz Band. So when I told them, they were freaking
out. Jazz Kitchen,
out.
You mean?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Jazz.
That's right.
Thank you. Jazz Kitchen. And like, they were just, like, completely geeked for me. Like, I tell my parents not to, like, travel out 3 hours from where to, like, go. But they were like, we are on it. We bought tickets.
Yes.
Like, I'm so excited. So I've, like, I've been in a practice room almost every day. Like, I cannot forget a lyric. I cannot miss a beat. Like, this is one of the biggest, like,
it's
performances
huge.
That I'll be doing, like, ever.
Well, I think we're going to see you a lot in the coming months Studio Band and then beyond. I look forward to see what you do post-Studio Band.
I really
appreciate I'm telling
that.
You what, it's amazing.
Thank you guys so much.
Involved with the Studio Band? Is it an audition situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Studio Band is an audition-based ensemble. We normally hold auditions the first week of the semester in the fall. Mm-hmm. So we've had quite a few students audition. Me and my colleague, Dr. Thompson, we sit through many hours of listening to the different instrumentalists and vocalists come through and audition, and then we kind of narrow it down and we make the group from there. We normally have 5 vocalists, 3 horns, 2 drummers who trade off. One plays drums, one plays percussion, 2 guitars, bass, and keys.
That's awesome. Do you hear from graduates that are still doing it, you know, and about their experiences they had with Studio Band?
And that's a good point to bring up. We do hear from graduates and alumni, and we have an alumni of the program, Cambria Moncrief. She's coming back to perform with us at the Jazz Kitchen.
Nice.
She's going to be our guest artist. So she was a student here. She's a graduate of the M&P program, and she was in Studio Band when it first started. She's one of the founding members.
An OG.
So yes, it's going to be great to have her come back and see how it's grown since she's been away and graduated.
That's awesome.
So it's going to be wonderful to have her come back.
Yeah.
It's kind of a full circle.
You
circle
can't
moment.
Have a better testimonial than that. Somebody actually moving on and doing that and then some. Mm-hmm. And how wonderful that she wants to come back and still share her talents. Mm-hmm. In case people are not aware, tell them why the Jazz Kitchen is such a huge thing for this group to be able to perform. This is the place where all of the jazz R&B greats perform on a regular basis, and you are on the calendar.
Yeah, so the Jazz Kitchen is the premier jazz venue in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many world-class Grammy-winning artists grace that stage. So it's really special for us to be able to do the same thing, and especially for the students. You know, a lot of the gigs we've played, it's their first time, like, performing outside of a school environment.
Wow.
So to go straight to like the jazz kitchen.
That's like 0 to 60 in two seconds.
It's a really cool thing. And, you know, the jazz kitchen, everybody, the staff, David Ali, the owner there, they're all great people, very much involved in uplifting the musicians and the community in Indianapolis. So that's a wonderful thing as well.
Well, congratulations on the success of Studio Band. We look forward to seeing you out in the community.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You can enjoy the Ball State Studio Band at We Fly Fest, Saturday, June 7th at the Brown Amphitheater on Ball State's campus.
And you can meet the Pop of Culture team. We'll be there as well.
We will.
This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. It's time to ask another local artist, what are you working on?
We're here with Stephen M. Melbin II. He is the manager of and lead designer at Screen Broidery, located in the Village in Muncie for over 15 years. And he is also a well-known local visual artist. Steve, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Of course. How did you get into making art initially?
Oh, it's funny. I was on live last night and somebody asked me that exact question. And my answer was, I was born into it.
Okay.
I have made art as long as I can possibly remember. My dad was an artist. My grandmother's an artist. My sister's an artist. My cousin's an artist. Like, so it's in the blood. I mean, okay, funny thing. I have made art out of just about every substance you can possibly think of that you can get your hands on. If there's dust on a window, I'll probably draw a picture in it.
Okay. That's
I've drawn in dirt. I've made images out of rocks. I like to carve things. I carved a little man in the middle of the jungle waiting on a tram to pick us up from a stop that was 6 hours away from any civilization, just sitting on a stump under a palm tree, carving a piece of wood, and carved it. And when I was done with it, one of the locals asked me for it, and he put a hole in it and put it on a necklace. So it's, yeah. I'm surprised I'm not doing it right now. I'm trying not to. That's why I turned my iPad off, so I wouldn't draw, because otherwise I'd be sitting here like,
You are totally welcome to do that. I understand. So it's kind of like a constant kinetic endeavor for you.
There's, you know, like there's certain things that you just do in your life, like because you want to, that's how you move. So you do those things on a regular. That's how it's, I can't help it. Like I told people, I'd go live every night. I go live every night at 9 p.m. on TikTok.
Oh.
I told people I was doing that way before TikTok, just nobody could see it. So it wasn't like I decided, oh, I'm going to start drawing every night. Like, no, I was always drawing every night. You just didn't see it. I just found a way to show it to other people. But I was going to do that regardless.
And you share it with those on TikTok?
I work on a lot of these on TikTok. This is where I work on them now. And it's gotten my workflow faster. So I used to make what I call urban mandalas.
Oh, okay.
They're basically doodles that I just decided to doodle in one place and repeat it. So it became a mandala.
Well, can you talk to us a little bit more about the mandala? Because it's hard for me to rectify in my mind the idea of that with a doodle.
Got it. No, I completely understand. So basically the way it works is, I'm going to give you a visual representation. It'll help. I'll actually show you the one I'm working on right now, or I just finished.
Please.
You just finished this one yesterday.
Amazing.
So basically what I do is I start in the middle and I just doodle whatever pops in my head. That's what I make. And
with
I just
insane
keep
precision
adding them together and pieces on top of pieces until you get that. And then once I finish drawing them, then I get the colors palette. I don't know what colors. People ask me a lot. They're like, oh, how do you plan that out? And I'm like, I don't. That's not a plan. That is the opposite of a plan. That right there is what happens when I don't plan. When I just sit down in front of my iPad and make something, that's what I make. And that took me 15 days from start to finish.
Well, there's a lot of vivid colors, and some people are probably familiar with the tradition of mandala, but what makes it an urban mandala?
Because it's not just – so mandalas have a very – I wouldn't say a strict structure, but they have certain things about mandalas that you see. The flowers, the lotus blossoms, the filigree, a lot of the little things that they put into stuff like that. Mine are like – my old 74 Coupe de Ville, mm-hmm. you know, a pair of roller skates, the beach ball we were playing with yesterday. They're also very timeline. Mm-hmm. So you can actually look at them. I can look at one. Like I have a painting. I started on the eclipse last year. Mm-hmm. I started that day. So it starts with a giant black circle. And then there's a ring of color around it. And then the mandala goes out from there. So there's bits of time. You guys are going to end up in a mandala. So IPR will end up in a mandala probably tonight or tomorrow, just because this is where I was today. So that will be a thing. So that is how those come along. They're very urban. They're just made up of not traditional shapes, but actual things.
I like that. I like that there's some universal themes that people can shared experiences that people can see in them. Mm-hmm. And you are talking about some of the things you're going to do with these mandalas. Can you mm-hmm. tell us about that?
So right now, like on my website, they're available. So I have the originals, which are the biggest of them all. They're anywhere from 30 by 30 to like 40 by 40. So they're really big. Wow. I only have a couple of those right now because people haven't really asked for them yet. And I hadn't figured out how I wanted to do it. But I'm also doing screensaver, so screen packs. So it's just a mandala for the background. So I'm working on those. I'm working on a coloring book.
Oh, what's that about?
It'll be these, mm-hmm. just with no color.
Okay. And you also mentioned painting. What are you painting these days?
Oh, you know what? I go back and forth. Me and painting have a love-hate relationship. I enjoy it, but it's one of those things that you have to plan. You have to make sure you have all the colors. You have to make sure you have your canvas. Make sure you have all this stuff together. So I don't do it often because it's just like, oh, I got to set up again. So I do a lot of micro paintings. So when I show like at First Thursday and when I even in my shop, I have them. I do like 3x3 square acrylics, like little small paintings. I'm working. I have a few larger ones in the shop, but I haven't done any real big paintings lately. But I've gessoed a few canvases just in case.
It's funny. People's perceptions are so different because you say, oh, I do the 3x3 micro paintings as if that's super easy. I'm just saying. You know.
Well, no, and it's funny because I know somebody who makes even small ones. They do them on quarters and dimes.
I feel like.
And I look at it like, oh, see, no, that's, I can't. That's too much detail. Look, that's too much detail for me. I can't do all that. That's ridiculous. Who would sit down and do that much detail?
Gotta have some patience. Yeah. So can you tell us where we can find your art and see you about town and online?
I mean, I'm always at my shop. I'm like the Italian mafia. I'd sit on the corner and I don't go anywhere. Everybody comes to me. So I'm always on the corner. I'm always in the village every day, 10 to 6 at the shop. I do a lot of these paintings in there as well, like after hours and stuff like that. Online, boondocksinkart.com. All of my socials are boondocksinkart. So
I'm so glad that you are part of the Muncie Arts community and very much appreciate you chatting with us
today.
Man,
I love it. This is my first podcast, by the way. Just so you know. So
well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We do too. Okay, Jen. It's that time again.
It's my favorite time.
The arts calendar. What's going on?
All right. This Friday, June 6th at 6:30 p.m., enjoy a tour of the summer skies at Charles W. Brown Planetarium on Ball State's campus. This live guided tour of the celestial wonderland that is the night sky includes provided star charts. Perfect for stargazers ages 8 and up, and there's parking right next to the planetarium. This event is open to the public. And a note, the planetarium will also be running shows during Ball State's We Fly Fest on Saturday, June 7th. Showtime's at bsu.edu/planetarium.
Another hallmark of the summer, the Hoosier Shakespeare Festival. Hoosier Shakes is celebrating its 10th year performing across East Central Indiana, and this season begins in Wabash at the Honeywell Center. Catch the classic tragedy Hamlet or the comedy Love's Labor Lost on alternating nights June 7th through the 10th. Shows begin at 6:30 p.m. Don't forget to bring something to sit on. See HoosierShakes.com for the full season schedule.
Down the street at the Eagles Theater, the Indiana Ballet Conservatory presents The Phantom of the Opera. This full-length ballet tells the story of the smash hit opera in an eclectic original form created by Indiana Ballet Conservatory's founder and artistic director, Alona Yakovleva. The curtain rises and the chandelier comes crashing down Saturday, June 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets at honeywellarts.org.
Friday, June 6th is the first Friday in Pendleton. That means it's time for a new art show at the 119 Gallery. Opening this month, the Pendleton Artists Society June Juried Art Show. Come see art from 6 to 8 p.m. Regular hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. The 119 Gallery is at, wait for it, 119 West State Street in Pendleton, and online at pasgallery119.org.
Also, a reminder that the Harlem Gospel Travelers will be performing at the Muncie Three Trails Music Series next Friday, June 13th. If you show up on Saturday, well, downtown Muncie is still a nice place to be.
If you have a nice place our listeners should be, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact and then select Pop of Culture.
Support for Pop of Culture comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and from you. Become a sustaining member of IPR and support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our director of audio operations is Sean Ashcraft, and our producer is Luke Jones, who is also a member of Hoosier Shakes. Not the repertory theater. It's a group of people from Indiana who love coffee. Our show was hosted by me, Kara Duquette.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University. And we'll hear the Ball State Studio Band
coming up.
Sorry. It's all right.